welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. With me today is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
Our guest is the legendary John East. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Dan. Mike, how are you?
Good morning, John.
Our topic today is Fairchild Semiconductor and the Traitorous Eight. When John started his semiconductor career at Fairchild in 1968, he got a front row view to this historic event. But first, let me ask you, Mike, would there be a Silicon Valley without Fairchild Semiconductor?
Yeah, you know, Dan, that's a really good question. And there's a little historical perspective there that I think drives home the point. I'm going to take you back to the early 80s when things were a little different and give you a point of view of who the anchor tenants were in those days. I was working at RCA in Somerville, New Jersey at the time, and we had a potential strategic development relationship with IBM Corporation in semiconductor manufacturing. So they invited us up to the Burlington, Vermont facility, their big manufacturing plant. And I remember we went up there, and this guy comes out and says, "Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to IBM Corporation, where we employ 8 times the number of people in all of Silicon Valley who work in semiconductors." And that sort of drove home the point of how powerful IBM was in those days. So he asked the question, what would have the East Coast been like without IBM? And the answer is nowhere. And then you think about the West Coast and Silicon Valley, and it came from very humble beginnings. And without something like Fairchild to provide the seed of innovation across multiple companies, I think we might see a different place today.
Yeah, I agree, Mike. Thanks for the East Coast perspective. You know, I was born and raised here on the West Coast, and you know, if you trace the roots to a lot of companies here in Silicon Valley, they all go back to Fairchild. So, yeah, I agree completely. So, John, before you tell us who the Traitorous Eight were, could you set the stage? You know, what was going on at that time?
Absolutely. Well, the Traitorous Eight all came out of Shockley Semiconductor. So let's do a quick run through what that was and who he was. William Shockley was, first of all, probably the smartest guy that ever lived. He definitely thought so, but the people who worked for him all thought so as well. Very bright guy. He was born in London. But his parents moved to Palo Alto when he was young, I think about 3 years old. And his parents were both engineers. They were mining engineers. So you could ask yourself the question, well, why are they moving to Palo Alto? Why don't they move to West Virginia or Colorado or someplace that mining engineers would live? And when we get done, I'll kind of come back to that point. But in any event, they didn't move to West Virginia. They moved to Palo Alto. He got educated in all the best schools, ended up with a PhD from MIT, and then went to Bell Telephone Laboratories, which is where all the important research was getting done in those days. And he teamed up with two other fellows, John Bardeen and Walter Brattain, and they invented the transistor. Shockley was the head of the little three-man group. Not that long afterwards, Shockley decided that he didn't want to work for Bell Telephone Laboratories and get a salary. He decided that he was, in fact, the best semiconductor physics guy in the world, and he was. And he should be able to open up a company and make these transistors and get rich. So when he did that, he resigned Bell Telephone Laboratories, and then he moved home to Palo Alto. He was able to make contact with a guy named Arnold Beckman, who was the founder and CEO of a company called Beckman Instruments. It was an important company back in those days. And Arnold Beckman was an important guy, in fact. And he got Beckman to agree to fund the company. And based on that, he opened up Shockley Semiconductor in Mountain View, California in 1955. So when he opened up Shockley Semiconductor, he went on an ambitious hiring campaign and went out to hire the very best and brightest engineers and scientists everywhere. And among others, he hired the Traitorous Eight.
So how did Shockley go about hiring? I heard he had a unique hiring process.
Yeah, he was really IQ oriented. He believed he was the smartest guy in the world, and he wanted all the people who were close to him to work for him. So he started out hiring only the scientists. Later he hired engineers, but when he went to get the scientists, he got not only PhDs, he got PhDs from the very finest universities who were at the very top of their class, a real brain trust. There were just brilliant, brilliant, brilliant people working there. He later figured out that he couldn't get everything done with these brilliant scientists, so he had to hire some engineers, and they were more normal people. He hired nobody from Bell, and he'd worked at Bell for more than a decade.
Okay, let's get to it. Who exactly were the Traitorous Eight?
Okay, Shockley was a tyrant, and on top of that, he was a paranoid. There are any number of stories about that, but they take some time to tell. I won't tell them now, but one deals with him hiring a private detective to administer a lie detector test to everybody that worked there. One deals with the fact that no one was allowed to talk to the person next to him to tell him what they were doing or what their results were. And remember, they all worked in this very small building. Basically, he treated the people like little kids. And that doesn't ever really work, but particularly when you're dealing with the very smartest guy to ever come out of MIT or ever come out of Caltech, and you treat him like a little kid, it just doesn't go down well. So there was a lot of discontent. And eventually, a few of them got together and decided that they needed to go to Beckman, who formerly owned the company, and explain to Beckman that this wasn't working well. And they didn't want to get rid of Shockley. That was unthinkable. But they did want some reasonable, rational human being of a boss to be put in between them and Shockley. And they were making some progress. They just about had Arnold Beckman convinced of that when Shockley was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics, which happened in 1956. So he went back and picked up the prize. And it was very, Nobel Prizes are just big deals, but that was a particularly big deal. Everybody everywhere in the world knew who Shockley was, and he's a very famous guy. So, and by the way, he didn't want anybody put between him and the people who worked for them. So Beckman was in a bind, and he eventually took Shockley's side. And he eventually told the people that begged for an in-between manager that they couldn't have it. They had to accept it as it was. And that caused seven of them to get together and say, we can't take this anymore. We're going to leave. But they wanted to market themselves as a package deal and sell themselves to some company, not sell themselves, but all take a job at some company. And they felt like they needed a leader to do that. And none of them were leaders. They were all more of the follower type. There was a guy named Bob Noyce that worked there that was just a born leader. Everybody that ever met him could see that. I met him later in life, and I could see it. So they eventually convinced Noyce to join them as their leader, and that made eight. And those eight then went to Shockley, gave him notice, and left. And he immediately gave them the name the Traitorous Eight. So that's where the name comes from. And they left the company, and there they were, no job. They didn't quite know what they were going to do. They were going to go do something, and they spent a lot of time trying to figure out what they were going to do. Now, I should at least name all of them. The eight that left were Sheldon Roberts, Gene Kleiner, Victor Greenwich, Jay Last, Robert Noyce, Julius Blank, Gordon Moore, and Jean Orny. So they there they were, no job, trying to figure out what to do with life.
So John, what happened to the eight after they left Shockley?
Well, as I just said, they spent some time trying to figure out what they were going to do, and it turned out to not be easy. They couldn't immediately find someone who wanted to hire all eight of them, and they did all want to stay together. So they were having some trouble. Now, one of the Traitorous Eight, a guy named Gene Kleiner, had a father who was involved in banking. It would have been investment banking kind of banking. And Kleiner called his father to ask what he thought. And Kleiner's father introduced the eight to a man named Arthur Rock. Arthur Rock worked at Hayden Stone, and his job was more or less what today you would call venture capital, although they didn't call it that at the time. Rock scratched his head a little bit and decided to introduce them to Sherman Fairchild. Sherman Fairchild was a very rich man. His father had been one of the really big shareholders of IBM. Sherman Fairchild was an engineer. He's a very bright engineer, and he's an entrepreneur. He'd already formed some companies, the most successful of which was Fairchild Camera, that was during the war involved in making reconnaissance cameras for the military. But he was an entrepreneur and a bright guy, and he understood the merit in semiconductors. So he decided that he would fund them and that they would all form a subsidiary of Fairchild Camera, and they would call that subsidiary Fairchild Semiconductor. And actually, he funded them, gave them money, and allowed it to be their company. But there was a proviso that if it did well, he would get them, they would have to sell the company back to him at a very nice profit for them. And that's what eventually happened. So after that deal was struck, they opened up Fairchild Semiconductor in a small building that's still there on Charleston Road in Mountain View. Actually, it's right on the border between Mountain View and Palo Alto. I'm never quite sure what city it's in. So that's that story. They all began work, Charleston Road, Fairchild Semiconductor.
What happened after that? You know, they joined Fairchild. What did they do that made them so famous?
Boy, a lot of stuff. So get comfortable, Dan. I'll give you some context to begin with. There was a problem that was kind of a new problem. Some people called it the numbers problem. It was a cousin of what still is referred to as a Rent's rule problem. But what was that problem? Let's take an example. Let's say you have four transistors, and in order to connect them and make something useful, it takes 10 wires. That's about right. I pulled it out of my rear, but that's about right. So if four transistors require 10 wires, how many wires does eight transistors require? And you'd say, well, if four needs 10, then eight needs 20. But that's not true. If you were building, say, a gate out of the first four and then a gate out of the second four, now you'd need to connect the gates together. So that might take another four or five. So just coming up with random numbers, four transistors took 10 wires, but eight transistors took 25 wires. Well, now how about 16 transistors? Would that be 50? No, it would be 60 or 70 or some bigger number. So it's an exponential. And what's the exponent that people argue about that even today? In the FPGA business, you spend a lot of time arguing about how many wires you need. But the exponential is somewhere greater than one and less than two. So in kind of smallish numbers, okay, fine, you can work with it. But wires are a pain. Wires are a lot harder than transistors, actually. You can make transistors in huge chunks on wafers. You make lots of them, mass production. But wires, you solder in place one at a time, and you get cold solder joints, and they take up a lot of space. So if you're talking about millions of transistors, the amount of interconnect required to connect them would be, or would have in those days, been totally unthinkable. So that was the numbers problem. We can't ever make something as big as we want to make because you can't possibly wire it together. And I told you that was a new problem. Why was it a new problem? Because the technology at the time was all based on vacuum tubes. And as perverse as this seems, I think I should explain a vacuum tube because there are a lot of people that have never seen one and don't really know what they are. So the simplified version of a vacuum tube is it's an electric light bulb. It's got some other stuff in there that they call grids and plates. You don't really need to know about that stuff. What you do need to know is to make it work, you had to put electric current through a filament, and it had to dissipate enough power that the filament glowed red hot. So there were some tubes sold that were called low power tubes, but that was a misnomer. To make a tube work, you had to heat the filament until the tube glowed red hot. And by the way, the filament would eventually fail just like an electric light bulb. So there was a wear out mechanism. So the tubes would go bad. But more importantly, the tubes were hot. So I did a little back of the envelope while I was getting ready to give this podcast. And I calculated that if you were trying to make a billion gate circuit, like a typical Apple IC, you would need 100 nuclear power plants to power the thing. And of course, that's laughable from two points of view. One is, my God, the space and money involved in 100 power plants. But more laughable is the fact, where's that power going? It's all going into these filaments, which are basically heaters. So I hope there's an ME or a thermodynamicist listening to this, and he knows how to do the calculation. I suspect that that billion gate ASIC would make the environment hotter than the surface of the sun, but I don't know that because I'm not good at thermodynamics, but I wish somebody would do that calculation and tell me. But obviously it was totally unpractical. So nobody worried about the NME being the wire problem. You couldn't get to the point where that would matter. But then all of a sudden the transistor came along and you could theorize very low power transistors. In fact, they were, relative to tubes, super low power to begin with. So the public enemy number one in those days was the wire. So there were a couple of guys who were working on that problem, among other things. They had lots of things to do, but that problem was in the back of their minds. And one was a guy named Jack Kilby. And based on that, he invented an integrated circuit in 1958. But the problem was he did, in fact, put a bunch of components on a slice of germanium, not silicon. But he didn't have a good answer to the connection problem. So he didn't really help the wire problem very much. You can Google it and look at what he first came out with. But basically, the connections were made by wire bonding techniques that are sort of like you bond an IC today with. So it really wasn't a very good solution. And he mentioned in his patent that the problem needed to be solved, but he didn't really say how to solve it. Then Bob Noyce came along 6 months later, and he did solve it. But he needed help to solve it. There was a man, one of the Traders eight people named Jean Orny, a brilliant guy. And he had worked on a problem of how to keep transistors from going bad. And his view was transistors do fail, but the physical mechanism of a transistor itself doesn't really cause failures. What causes failures is the transistor just sits out in the open and stuff gets on it, and that makes it fail. So his view is we can put a stop to that if you just lay down a layer of silicon dioxide, or even better, grow a layer of silicon dioxide on top of the transistor. That would passivate the transistor, would keep bad stuff from getting in, and now the transistor won't go bad. So he patented that invention, and people jumped on that, recognized it was a very good thing to do. Fairchild immediately started making a transistor line that did that. But Bob Noyce took a look at it and said, well, wow, you know what? Silicon dioxide is an insulator. So I can just lay the wires, the interconnect, right down on top of that silicon dioxide, and I can pattern it just like a PC board. I can basically lay my own PC board down right on top of all those transistors. So that was what Noyce patented. And in fact, that really worked, and it really solved the problem of wires. So there was a big patent battle that went on. It was fought for years, but it was fought between companies because Kilby and Noyce really liked each other, and they both really respected each other, and they both gave each other a ton of credit. So Dan, you asked what happened, why did they then become famous? Well, that was the first reason. Kilby and Noyce, but particularly Noyce, invented a working integrated circuit.
All right. So Noyce and Kilby came up with the idea of the integrated circuit and the first working one. But who actually, you know, made the first commercial integrated circuits?
Great question that hardly anybody else ever asks. But the fact is, I just pointed out that Noyce invented a real working integrated circuit. But I was stretching the truth a little there because nobody had thought about the problem of isolation. So Noyce put together a patent that described you put several transistors on the same piece of silicon and you wire them together with this printed circuit board technique. And wow, it's wonderful, isn't it? But nobody asked the question, well, gee, if you have more than one transistor in that chunk of silicon, why don't the transistors talk to each other? Why isn't there a leakage current that goes back and forth between them? And of course, we today call that the isolation problem. In the early days, they didn't even have a name for it yet, but they knew it was a big problem. How do you keep these things from talking to each other? And nobody had a good idea for how to solve that. So Noyce assigned the problem of making an integrated circuit to a guy named Jay Last, another one of the Traders Eight. And Last went out to work on it. He didn't work by himself, but he worked with a team that mostly was not comprised of other Traders Eight people. But it took him a couple of years to get it solved. So in 1961, Jay Last put down on the table in front of Bob Noyce a working chunk of silicon that had a working integrated circuit on it, 2 years after Noyce's invention.
So what happened after that, John?
They weren't even close to done. But the first significant thing that happened after that was four of the Traders Eight decided, hey, this is a pretty good deal. I like this idea, and it's going to be huge, and we're going to open our own company to do this. So Roberts, Last, Kleiner, and Ornee left to form Amelco. Amelco changed names a bunch of times. It kept getting bought by this company and that company, but it's still around today. It just happens to be owned by Microchip. So I'm sure they don't use the name Amelco anymore, but that's where the remnants reside. So if you want to know more about Amelco, you give Steve Sange a call in Arizona and he'll tell you. But in any event, four down, eight to go. Only four of the Traders Eight were left, but there you had a competitive company, Amelco, that was competing with Fairchild. Shortly after that, Kleiner, who was one of the founders of Amelco, decided there was a better way to make money. I remember his father was involved in banking. He left Amelco to form Kleiner Perkins and opened up an office in Palo Alto on Sand Hill Road. So that was the first venture capital company on Sand Hill Road, which of course ended up driving the valley. Various venture capital companies on Sand Hill Road were what helped really put this whole thing together. So there were kind of a couple of venture capital firsts there. Hayden Stone, which was the company Arthur Rock worked at Hayden Stone, and that was kind of the first venture capital company period. But the first venture capital company in Silicon Valley was Kleiner Perkins. The Traders Eight had a lot to do with venture capital. Shortly after Kleiner left, Ornee, who people who worked for him loved the guy, but I guess he was very sensitive and easily hurt his feelings and what have you, decided he didn't like it at Amelco. So he left to form Union Carbide, and then he left Union Carbide to form Intersil. And then he didn't leave Intersil, but he moved to Europe to do a European version of Intersil. So he was very entrepreneurial. So those four guys went off and did a bunch more startups, but there were still four of the eight left at Fairchild. In 1965, Gordon Moore published an article, I think it was Electronics Magazine. If not Electronics, it was Electronic Designs. It was one of those magazines. And the title of it was Cramming More Components Onto an Integrated Circuit. So it didn't sound all that formal. But you can Google that and come up with the article. And in that article is his first plot of Moore's Law. And in those days, they were still making chips with a handful of components. So he plotted it out over 10 years and concluded that 10 years down the road, they could be making a chip with 64,000 components. Of course, then it got extended to 64 million, and now we're working on 64 billion, and we're having debates regularly with respect to has it reached the end of the road yet. And of course, you've seen all kinds of changes in it. It used to be doubling every year, and then it was doubling every year and a half, and then doubling every 2 years, and people are predicting it's going to totally stop. My own prediction is the doubling 1 year to one and a half to two goes to four, goes to eight, and pretty soon it's on a log plot, but I don't think it ever totally goes away. The fun will mostly be gone. So that happened in 1965. Then in early 1968, Victor Greenwich left Fairchild, and he originally left to go into academia. He taught at Berkeley. He got there just as I left, but I didn't meet him there. But he had the bug, and so after teaching at Berkeley for a while, he left Berkeley and opened up Escort Memory Systems, and then Arcos Designs, so he had the startup bug as well. Later in 1968, Noyce and Moore left to form Intel. Of course, everybody knows that story. And so when I got there in 1968 in the fall, the only one left was Julius Blank. But I didn't know anything about the Traitorous Eight at the time. I didn't know anything about Julius Blank. I wish I had. I could have gone to meet him. It was physically a very small area. There were three buildings. He had to be in one of them. So I could have gone to meet the guy, but I didn't know he was still there. And worse than that, I didn't know when he left in 1969. You'd think there would have been some fanfare about the last of them leaving, but there wasn't. So I met him much later in life, but one day he just dropped out and nobody knew it. So by 1969, all eight of the Traitorous Eight had left. I didn't tell you, by the way, that Julius Blank had a brilliant idea for making money. There were so many startups going on at the time that he decided to open a consulting company, just consulting with these startups, teaching them how to go about doing startups. And he did very well doing that, but he couldn't stand it. He wanted to get in on the ground floor of the action again. So he then founded Zycor, which did really well. So all eight of them were gone. All eight of them had done startups. That led to what you see today. So what happened afterward, Dan? That's my answer. They all eventually left and started companies.
Great. Hey, John. Just the last question. Just to summarize, why should we care about the Traitorous Eight?
Well, Traitorous Eight bought my house. They sent my kids to school. What little I have in life, I owe to them. So that's why I care. But I'm popping it up one level. They gave the world the integrated circuit. They gave the world the startup fever that goes on even today. And they put venture capital on the map. I could make an argument that the first venture capital came from them, but if it wasn't the first, it was the most important. It was what put venture capital on the map. So those changed the world without any doubt. But a question I ask myself a lot, and it's something you started this this podcast out with, Dan, goes like this. John, are you arguing that there wouldn't have been ICs and startups and VCs without the Traitorous Eight? No, I wouldn't argue that at all. Those inventions, those happenings would have taken place. It's just that somebody else would have done it at some other time. But then I ask myself the question, well, okay, Shockley moved from London, where he was born, to Palo Alto, and that was his home. And so when he opened up Shockley Semiconductor, he went home, opened it in Palo Alto. That was the only reason. There wasn't any great infrastructure here. It's just that that's where he'd grown up and he liked it. His mother still lived there. His father passed away, but his mother still lived there. So he went home to open it up. But what was his mother doing there? She should have been in West Virginia or Colorado. She was a mining engineer. His father was a mining engineer. What if they had worked where you would think that they would have worked? Would Silicon Valley have sprung up in West Virginia? Maybe that's not likely, but it's super likely that it would have sprung up in Boston, because Shockley had gone to school at MIT. Or you can make an argument, maybe it wouldn't have happened at all. It's known that the Russians were working on ICs at the time, and the Japanese were, so it could have been that those inventions and that progress would have happened in the USSR during the middle of the Cold War, or in Tokyo post-war. So what would the world have looked like if that had happened? I don't know. It's a good question, and some philosopher could probably answer the question well, but I know the world wouldn't have looked the way it looks today. Traitorous Eight obviously put Silicon Valley on the map, but they may have put a lot of the American economy on the map as well. My own personal view is that they did. America would be a different place had it not been for Shockley and the Traitorous Eight.
Yeah, I agree completely. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, John. Excellent content. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.